Thus have I heard on one occasion the Venerable Ananda was living in a village near Visali. Now on that occasion the householder Dasama of this village had arrived at Pataliputta for some business or other. Then he went to the monk in Kuktuka's park. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him, "Where does the Venerable Ananda live?" "Venerable sir, I wish to see Venerable Ananda." "The Venerable Ananda is living in a village near Visali." Then the householder Dasama had completed his business. He went to the Venerable Ananda. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him, "Venerable Ananda, has any one thing been proclaimed by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, his unliberated mind becomes liberated, his undestroyed taints come to be destroyed, and he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before? There is, householder, indeed one such thing proclaimed by the Blessed One." "What is that one thing, Ananda?" "Here, householder, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states." Now, isn't this interesting? There's one thing that leads to supreme bondage, or freedom from bondage. And then he starts talking about jhana. Isn't that something? "A monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought with joy and happiness born of seclusion. He considers this and understands it thus: this first jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced." You have to point your mind towards it in order to attain it. "But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he is steady in that, he attains the destruction of the taints." So what this is actually saying is it doesn't matter what jhana you're in, you can have the cessation at any time. And I've told you that I've had some students that didn't go all the way up to neither perception nor non-perception. They were in the realm of infinite space, and then they had a cessation. So that's why I've said in other talks, I'm not sure I've said it with you, but you can be in any of the jhanas, you have the potential to attain nibbana. That means that your mind is pure at that time. When you're in the jhana, you don't have hindrances arise. Hindrances arise because your mindfulness is weak and you're not staying with your object of meditation. That's why I tell you to use the 6 R's when your attention is pulled away. But if he does not attain to the destruction of the taints because of that desire for the Dhamma, that delight in the Dhamma, then with the destruction of the five lower fetter, he becomes one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes. On that chart that's on in the dining hall, we have many of those charts. If you want to take them, they're underneath the table and back. You can have one and take it with you. It's a good teaching tool. My friend made it. Yeah. Turn it up a little bit.
Okay.
Testing, 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 testing. That's up all the way. I can't go any higher. That is loud, though, to me. Is that better?
Yeah.
Now? Okay. So the reappearing spontaneously in the pure abodes means that you have become an anagami. You still have some fetters. You still have, much to your disappointment, restlessness and sloth and torpor. And you can still have the desire to be reborn in one of the higher abodes. You still have a little bit of pride. And you have ignorance. And from there you will attain final nibbana without ever returning back from that world. So you're not never going to be reborn a human being again. There's a lot of relief in that. You spontaneously appear as an adult. Okay? That means you don't have to go through teenage. That's probably the hardest part of being a human being. This is the one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened. Herein, if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated. His undestroyed taints come to be destroyed. He attains the supreme security from bondage that had not been attained before. Again, with the stilling of thinking and examining thought, a monk enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which is accompanied by confidence and stillness of mind. Still experiencing joy, but this kind of joy is a little bit stronger. You feel a little bit lighter in your mind and your body. But there's still some excitement in it. It's a nice state to be in. He considers this and understands thus, the second jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he is steady in that, he attains the destruction of the taints. But if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, without ever, he becomes an anagami. This has the dot, dot, dots. And he, without ever reappearing in the human state. So this can, you can attain Nibbana at any time. While you're doing the meditation, while you're practicing being in one of the jhanas or in one of the bases. It doesn't happen very often, I do have to say that. It depends on you, your understanding, and how much dust you have in your eyes. This is a very natural process. It will happen as fast as it needs to happen. I've told this story a few times of someone coming to me and saying, "You're pushing me too fast through the jhanas." And I don't push anybody in the jhanas. I encourage you to sit longer because I know the advantage of that. But that's about all I do. I'm giving you information about which jhana you're in. And by my knowing which jhana you're in, I know how to talk to you, what to say. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One. Wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, he can attain supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. Again, with the fading away of joy, a monk enters upon and abides in the third jhana. Which has equanimity, and you're mindful and fully aware, still feeling happiness with the body, comfort. He enters upon and abides in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce he has a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. I had a student that had been teaching meditation for 20 years. And he started practicing the way that I teach, which was different than what he was teaching. And he came to me for an interview with this look of wonder on his face. And he said, "I finally understand what it means to have a pleasant abiding here and now." Always before, he was pushing. He was trying to force. And when he stopped, he saw how pleasant it really is. So he was real happy about that. He considers this and he understands thus. This third jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he is steady in that and he attains to the destruction of taints, but if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, he will become an anagami. So this very much agrees with the Satipatthana Sutta. only way you can attain Nibbana by listening very attentively to a sutta, and your understanding can be such that you can become a sotapanna. Or you can even become a sakadagami, but the only way to become an anagami is through meditation or an araha. You have to have the meditative experience. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. Again, with the complete abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, you enter upon and abide in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Then he considers this and understands it thus. The fourth jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. That just means pointing your mind towards a quieter state of mind. You're seeing this all happen on its own. It's not like you're making a conscious decision, I'm going to get into this jhana or that jhana. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he's steady in that, he attains to the destruction of the taints. But if he has not attained the destruction of the taints, he becomes an anagami. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, he attains a supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. I'm going to go to another sutta. Okay, the person, the view of a person such as this is called harmonious perspective. His intention is his, I don't like the word intention because that makes it too heavy. His imaging is right imaging. His harmonious practice is correct harmonious practice. His mindfulness is correct mindfulness. His collectedness is right collectedness. But his bodily action, verbal action, and livelihood have already been purified earlier. This is something that has been debated between practicing monks and studying monks, and it's happened for about 2300 years. The practicing monks say, no, this is part of the practice, and you can't say it's already purified because of the words that are being used a lot. harmonious communication, watching your mind and how your mind stays in harmony without that critical thought about, I think I should be doing better. Or making a mistake and telling yourself how stupid you are for doing it. So, the scholars say no. And what, by taking out the bodily action, the verbal action, and the livelihood, what we're talking about now, and that's verbalization in your mind, we're talking about not experiencing the Eightfold Path anymore, because you say, well, it's already purified. It's a fivefold path. Thus, this noble eightfold path comes to fulfillment in him by development. When he develops the eightfold path, the four foundations of mindfulness also come to fulfillment in him by development. The four kinds of right effort, or harmonious practice, or use the six R's, also comes to fulfillment in him by development. And it goes through the five faculties and the five powers, and they're basically all the same thing. And the seven awakening factors. Now, these are called the requisites for awakening. There was a very famous monk in the, I think he died in around 1950, but he was considered really a very good scholar. He was the number one in the country for his scholarship. And he wrote about 100 books, and he was considered the official person. Although he was taking the Visuddhimagga as his guide. Anyway, he's the one that said, these are the requisites for awakening. But he called it, they call it enlightenment. And I don't like that word, because enlightenment is not the same as waking up. When you wake up to the fact of you're doing something and you're causing yourself suffering, or you're causing suffering to someone else, when you wake up to that fact, then you're not going to do it anymore. But if you are enlightened, that means you're still thinking about it. So that's a different kind of approach. And they use the word enlightening a lot because of the Hindu influence in the world. Oh, he's an enlightened master. Back in the 60s and 70s, started reading Ram Dass books, and my guru was enlightened. He was awake in a lot of ways, but he still had some things that he was doing that wasn't so enlightening. He had some psychic abilities, but that doesn't mean that you're awake. It does mean that you can be enlightened about certain things, but when you really become awake, there's no more going back, making the same mistake over and over again, that sort of thing. There are two things, serenity and insight, and they occur to him yoked evenly together. It's like running a bull cart. If one of the bulls pulls harder than the other, then you're going to go in circles. You keep having to adjust to try to get back. So this is a mistake that a lot of people practicing straight Vipassana make. Because, well, the only way to get awakened is through Vipassana. And they have to be equally yoked together with a collected mind, with a mind that gets very still and quiet, that doesn't have hindrances arising in it, which is another way of saying jhana. He fully understands by direct knowledge those things that should be fully understood by direct knowledge. He abandons by direct knowledge those things that should be abandoned by direct knowledge. He develops by direct knowledge those things that should be developed by direct knowledge. He realizes by direct knowledge those things that should be realized with direct knowledge. And again, this is one of the arguments that monks have that are scholars, as compared to someone who has direct practice. A scholar can never become an anagami unless they do the direct practice. They can never become fully awakened unless they do the direct practice. But there's a lot of pride in scholarship. It's just like going to any college, really. You have some, you go to an archaeologist and you have a guy that's out in the field and he's digging up all of these things and it doesn't agree with the philosophy of the people that don't. So there's always fighting between them. For instance, there is very definite knowledge that the Egyptians came to this country 5,000 years ago. They went up the Mississippi River, and there's a place in Illinois that they call Little Egypt. They've gone into caves and they've gotten Egyptian artifacts, but that doesn't agree with the archaeologists in the schools. And now it's banned. You can't go there anymore. And part of the Grand Canyon is the same way. It's banned because there's so many relics that don't agree with the common knowledge right now. Now that's going to change before too long, I think. But so learning by direct knowledge means that your mind is very quick to recognize and see how it does arise. If you just have book learning, then you have to try to go back to your memory and see whether it agrees with what you remember or not, and it's all verbalization in your mind. I've talked to some Christians who come up to me when I was in Washington, D.C. And they would start talking about meditation and they said, well, where is Jesus in all of this? Can't we be praying to Jesus? I said, well, you're doing this practice? No. It slows down everything because it's a concept. It's not seeing the reality of how it happens. And when you get into the different base, like infinite consciousness, and you're seeing individual consciousnesses arise and pass away, you realize that somebody that just has book learning, they don't understand when they try to describe what it is. They use other people's ideas, but because they don't have the direct experience, they don't really understand it deeply. And what things should be abandoned by direct knowledge? Ignorance and craving. These are the things that should be abandoned by direct knowledge. And what things should be developed by direct knowledge? Jhana practice and insight. So we're talking about samatha vipassana or samadhi vipassana, depending on how you want to look at it. And what things should be realized by direct knowledge? True knowledge and deliverance. These are the things that should be realized by direct knowledge. When one knows and sees the ear as it actually is, these are the things that should be realized by direct knowledge. In other words, seeing the individual consciousnesses. It's not one continuous sound. It's arising and passing so fast that you don't recognize it. People that do their intellectual studies don't realize that. So that's why they argue quite a bit with the monks that have the direct knowledge. There was two brothers that became monks at the same time. One of them was an older monk, or older brother, and then the younger brother, but they ordained at the same time. The older brother said, "I don't have time to learn all of the suttas by heart. I'm going to go off and practice." The younger monk did. He memorized all the suttas and became quite popular because he had that kind of good recall and good memory. Well, the older monk came to visit the younger monk. And because the younger monk had such pride, he thought, "I'm going to ask my brother some questions that he can't answer." And the Buddha came around at that time, and he started asking the Sutta monk the answer to some questions that he couldn't answer, and he asked the Arahat and he gave the right answer. And that took away some of the pride from the younger brother. So it's a real interesting situation. We need to have both, and we actually shouldn't be arguing too much with each other. Because in the Third Buddhist Council, they decided that the best way to keep the Buddhism alive, the Buddha's teaching alive, was through memorizing the suttas and studying the suttas and that sort of thing. And during that time, there was probably only 5 or 6% of the monks that did meditation. It's about like that today. a lot of monks, Asian monks, they really like to have letters behind their name. M.A., Ph.D., these kind of things that brings them up in other people's minds. But like I told you, there is talk about my getting an honorary Ph.D., and the only people I would really tell about that is my brothers, just to put them down a little bit. So, anyway, let's get back to this. Okay, we got to the fourth jhana. Whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he is steady in that, he attains the destruction of the taints. So every one of these different jhanas, you have the potential to attain nibbana. And staying in the jhana for longer periods of time, you get to learn a lot about it. Excuse me. There's one of the suttas that all of the monks were going out during the day, and they would sit until dark, and then quite often the Buddha would give a Dhamma talk, so they'd all come straggling back in. And Ananda saw Sariputta walking in, and he said, "Bhante, your features are very bright. Your face is very clear. What jhana did you sit in today?" "I sat in the first jhana all day." When you're able to do that, you're able to learn a lot about the first jhana. And he was always interested in the intellectual pursuits like that. The next day, Ananda sees Sariputta walking towards him. "Bhante, your features are very bright. Your face is very clear. What sutta or what jhana did you sit in today?" "I sat in the second jhana." So it happens in every one of the jhanas. He could sit in all of the bases for all day. And this means, let's say you go out for alms round around 7:30 in the morning. You spend about an hour walking on alms round, getting your exercise. Then you come back, take a shower, eat, take a short rest. The rest of the day, you're sitting in meditation. So you might be sitting and walking both, but he might be sitting for, oh, let's say by 10 o'clock he's ready to start. Then around 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening he would finish, and that would be his day's abiding. So he'd sit for, let's say 7 o'clock, that would be 9 hours. Okay. Now, there's a minimum time of sitting here, and that is 6 hours. I prefer that you sit 8 hours because of the advantage of doing it. Don't ask me how long you should be sitting at one time. I'm just giving you fair warning, because my answer is always going to be a lot longer than you feel like sitting, like you can sit that long. 8 hours, 9 hours, sit. I have students that can do that. This one student, she was progressing very fastly, very quickly, and she got to be an Anagami. She came, "How long did you sit today?" "Well, I started at 2 in the morning, and I stopped at lunchtime, 11 o'clock. That's a lot of hours to be sitting. And her face was very radiant, very clear, very bright. So it's a real tricky question. I give you suggestions. Sitting 3 hours is better than 2. Sitting 4 hours is better than 3. But you can keep going if you want. One of the students that was just here sat for 5.5 hours without moving. Good. Excellent. When your sitting is good, don't break it. Don't just get up. It drives me crazy when that happens. I had a student in Indonesia. She was a great meditator, really good. She would get into neither perception nor non-perception with her daily practice. She'd sit for an hour. Nothing came up. So she got up and started arguing, "I got to go do this and do that." And I kept on telling her to stop doing that. Keep sitting. 3 years. 3 years of my complaining to her and scolding her and saying, "You got to sit longer." Finally, she heard it. Then she really progressed fast. But she was breaking the sitting at an hour. Don't put limits on yourself like that. Sit longer. Sometimes there's a pain that comes up in your body. Okay. It's a mental pain, but you continue sitting. It's only a different kind of hindrance. It's a different kind of restlessness that makes you want to break your sitting. Sit through that, if you can. When a meditation pain arises, it seems real. Seems like it's really, really intense. When you get up and start walking, it goes away very quickly. That is a meditation pain. Then use the wish. Bring up a wish of either tranquility, stillness, or equanimity. Keep sitting. I do have some students that they will sit right through it. Did the pain go away? No, but it didn't bother me anymore. It eventually goes away. But when it becomes a disturbance to your mind, who's caught by that restlessness? Who's not recognizing that as a hindrance? Well, but it hurt so bad, I just got up and started walking. Well, try sitting through it. Just tell yourself, I'll sit for another 10, 15 minutes and see what happens. If it doesn't go away, okay, get up and start walking. But you'll watch that disappear so quick. And then you go, well, why did I break that sitting? It was pretty good. People break the sitting because of restlessness a lot. Oh, my mind was racing all over the place. Well, adjust it. When you have that hindrance arise in your mind, you're not staying with your object of meditation. You're not purifying your mind. You're identifying with that distraction. And you're trying harder and harder to make it stop. And that's exactly the opposite of what you need to do. You need to back off. Relax. Don't get so caught up in it. Recognize it for what it is. It's only a disturbance. And it certainly isn't even yours. You didn't ask it to come up. Why did it come up? Because your mindfulness wasn't sharp enough. You didn't see the very beginning of how it arose. If you did, it'll go away very quickly without being troublesome to you. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein if a monk abides diligent-hearted and resolute, he attains the supreme security from bondage, nibbana, or he will become an anagami. Again, monks, a monk abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above and below. Doesn't that sound like some instructions that I gave you? Okay. And all around. So after you do the six directions for 5 minutes, then you do all around, in all the directions at the same time. To all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. He considers this and understands it thus. This deliverance of mine through loving-kindness is conditioned. But whatever is conditioned is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he's steady in that, he attains to the destruction of the taints, becomes an arahat. But if he doesn't, he becomes an anagami. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, he attains the supreme security from bondage, if he had not attained it before. Again, a monk abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion. Oh. Doesn't this sound familiar? He considers this, and he goes through all of the four quarters and above and below and all around. And he considers this and understands it thus. The deliverance of mind through compassion is conditioned. But whatever is conditioned is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he's steady in that and attains to the destruction of the taints, but if he's not, if he has not attained the destruction of the taints, he becomes an anagami. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. He attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. Again, a monk abides pervading one quarter with the mind imbued with joy. And the second quarter, and the third quarter, and the fourth, and above, and below, and all around. He considers this and understands it thus. The deliverance mind through joy is conditioned. But whatever is conditioned is impermanent. Every conditional state, all of the links of dependent origination, are conditioned. They won't arise if there's no condition, right? It's like I was telling you, you have contact arise. If you see that contact and use the 6 R's right then, no feeling is going to arise. If no feeling arises, no craving arises. If there's no craving, there's no clinging. If there's no clinging, there's no habitual tendency. If there's no habitual tendency, there's no birth of action. If there's no birth, no sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, or despair arises. How do you become content with your practice? Sharpen your mindfulness so you can see these links, these conditional links. And by 6R-ing, you're letting go of the condition for the next link to arise. Okay? Again, a monk abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise, the second, the third, the fourth, above, below, and all around. He considers this and understands it thus. This deliverance of mind through equanimity is conditioned. But whatever is conditioned is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he's steady and stays with that for a period of time, he can become an arahat even, or at least a sotapanna. It can happen at any time. That's one of the reasons I truly like this sutta, because it's a reminder that if your mind is settled and you're keeping your practice going all the time, it can happen while you're washing your face. It can happen while you're taking a shower. It can happen while you're going to the toilet. It can happen at any time, but you have to stay with your object of meditation all the time. Don't let your mind ho-hum around or become distracted. Oh, the bird. Oh, there's a rabbit. Don't let your mind become distracted with this kind of thing. That's only a hindrance. Or you see something out of the corner of your eye, your curiosity comes up and says, what was that? Now, that question right there says, your mindfulness is weak. Your mindfulness is not strong. It's strong because it doesn't matter what it was. If you allow your mind to get pulled away from your object of meditation, that's distraction. That's hindrance. So, too, this is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, and he attains supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. Again, by complete surmounting of gross perceptions of form, with the disappearance of gross perceptions of sensory impact. That means you don't feel your body unless there's contact. Oh, but I got a pain in my bottom. Where'd that come from? It came from a lack of mindfulness in seeing how it arose at the very beginning. You have to sharpen your mindfulness. Very important. Aware that space is infinite. Now, when I talk about infinite space, I'm talking about compassion with infinite space, because I teach the Brahmaviharas. If you're doing mindfulness of breathing, you don't have that. It's just infinite space, which is an expansion that happens in all directions at the same time and keeps going out. There's no limit to it. He considers this and understands the attainment of the base of infinite space is conditioned. But whatever is conditioned is impermanent, subject to cessation. They're all conditioned by your ability to stay with your mindfulness, your observation. And by the previous jhana, yeah. But some people skip jhanas. That's always fun trying to figure that one out. Sometimes your mind will give you what I call a preview of coming attractions. And you'll be sitting in the fourth jhana and all of a sudden you see, very briefly, you see infinite space, and then very briefly you see infinite consciousness, and very briefly you see equanimity, and then your mind becomes very quiet. And then it goes back to the fourth jhana. So you get a preview of coming events, just like going to the movies. That doesn't happen very often anymore. It used to happen a lot more than it does now. Why, I'm not sure. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, and he gets to attain Nibbana, again by completely surmounting the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite. A monk enters upon and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. He considers this and understands it thus. This attainment of the base of infinite consciousness is conditioned by all the meditation you did before. But whatever is conditioned is impermanent, subject to change. If he's steady in that and he attains to the destruction of taints, he becomes an arahat. If not, he becomes an anagami. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. He attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. By completely surmounting the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing, a monk enters upon and abides in the base of nothingness. He considers this and understands it thus: that attainment of the base of nothingness is conditioned. So isn't it interesting that we put in the Brahma Viharas before we put in the other bases? And I think that actually is a mistake. They should put them in and kind of interwove them, interweave them, so that you can understand. And I'll show you why in just a minute.
I'm confused about the difference between the base and the jhana.
The base is... Okay. You have four jhanas. When you get to the fourth jhana, it has four bases to it. Right. But don't call it jhana, although they call it arupa jhana, which gets a little confusing, but that's okay. But whatever is conditioned is impermanent, subject to cessation. If he is steady in that, he attains to the destruction of taints, or he becomes an anagami. Because of that pointing his mind in the direction of the wholesome. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, his unliberated mind becomes liberated. His undestroyed taints come to be destroyed, and he attains to that supreme security from bondage if he had not attained it before. When Ananda had spoken, the householder Dasama said to him, "Venerable Ananda, just as if a man seeking one entrance to a hidden treasure came all at once upon 11 entrances to hidden treasure, so too, while I was seeking one door to the deathless, I have come all at once to hear 11 doors to the deathless." Now, actually, personally, I think Ananda should have gone on to neither perception nor non-perception and then explained the cessation, but that happens in other suttas. Just as if a man had a house with 11 doors, when that house caught on fire, he could flee to safety by any one of the 11 doors. So I can flee to safety by any one of these 11 doors to the deathless. Venerable sir, these sectarians will even seek a teacher's fee for their teacher. Why shouldn't I make an offering to the Venerable Ananda? Then the householder, Dasama, assembled the Sangha of monks and with his own hand he served and satisfied them with various kinds of good food and presented a pair of cloths for each monk. and presented a triple robe to the Venerable Ananda, and he had a dwelling worth 500 pieces of gold built for the Venerable Ananda. And then Ananda left, went someplace else. What are you shaking your head for? That happens with monks. Life as a monk is open and free. It's not crowded and dusty. I can. Conditions are, this happens in a very systematic way, and the jhana before is the condition for this jhana to arise. Do you understand what I said? If you conditioned your mind with the second jhana, and then you go deeper, that condition of the second jhana is the reason that you get into the third jhana. That's the condition that allows for that to happen. Just like every one of the links of dependent origination. That's where Sati, son of a fisherman, was confused. Because he said, the consciousness ran and wandered through the realms of rebirth, and it was the same consciousness. That's a Hindu idea, a Brahmin idea. And it doesn't agree with what the Buddha is talking about. Each link has a condition right before it so that it will come up. But when you eliminate that with the six parts, then the rest of those don't have a condition for arising. That's why I went through that. If you see contact starting to come up and you six are right then, no feeling is going to come up. If there's no feeling, there's no craving. If there's no craving, there's no clinging. Every link before is the condition for the next link to arrive. This is how you purify your mind, by sharpening your mindfulness more and more so you can see how these things arise. And when you become more and more familiar with, oh, I recognize that, you catch it more quickly. Then the other conditions don't arise, and that leads to happiness, that leads to contentment. So this is a real interesting sutta because it keeps on bringing up a lot of things that are quite interesting that you will be able to experience for yourself. And like I said, I would have preferred that he would have gone all the way, but so there was the example of the Brahma Viharas in that. And that is real important to realize, that the Brahma Viharas was actually taught more than mindfulness of breathing was. Everybody really gets into mindfulness of breathing. But not everybody follows the directions of mindfulness of breathing. And that's where you get led off of the path. So I prefer teaching loving kindness meditation and the Brahma Viharas. For one reason, your progress is very fast. Mindfulness of breathing, if somebody comes and they've already been doing that, it takes about 6 weeks to correct their mistake so that they don't do it anymore, and to start getting into jhana. It takes a long time. Too many people want to focus on the breath instead of using the breath as a reminder to relax. That's a problem, because you go from the tranquil wisdom insight meditation to one-pointed absorption concentration. And people that practice Vipassana, they are very correct when they say that one-pointed concentration does not lead to Nibbana. They are correct. They don't understand why they're correct. They don't see that there is more than one kind of jhana. They just lump it all together, just like trying to lump Buddhism into religion. It just doesn't work. But they didn't know where else to put it. And there's an awful lot of Buddhist practice that is rites and rituals for the common person. And it doesn't lead to Nibbana. Do you have another question? Okay. Let's share some merit then. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddhist dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.